طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر. تسكله ماسا لون وطن، تسكله ماسا لون وطن، نفقا لعودة اللاجئين لعودة اللاجئين وفراش المنفى من شتات وتغريب.
Welcome to the July 13th edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fam and continued in his memory by a group of his dedicated friends. Every week, This Week in Palestine brings you news and views from a distinctly Palestinian perspective, a perspective seldom heard in the United States. On today's show, we feature an interview with Jadaliah co-editor Moin Rabini about the ongoing Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip and recent incursions into the West Bank. Rabani addresses the underlying causes of Israel's latest aggression against the Palestinian people. But first, let's listen to the weekly news update, courtesy of the International Middle East Media Center.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, Gaza Special Coverage, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.immc.org, for July 5th to the 11th, 2014. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed so far due to the ongoing Israeli military offensive targeting the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Palestinian leadership has asked for international intervention to end the escalating Israeli aggression against Palestinians. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Monday of this week, Israel started a massive military attack against the Gaza Strip. On Friday, 12 Palestinians were killed as Israeli bombardment continued to target the coastal enclave, bringing the death toll since Monday to 100 people killed and more than 650 injured. Among those killed, there are 25 children, Palestinian medical sources reported. Israeli warplanes continued to target residents' homes, hospitals and schools, local sources reported. More than 150 homes have been leveled to the ground after being targeted by Israeli missiles. From Gaza, IMEMC's Ram El-Meghari says Israel is targeting residents' homes at random.
Israel has kept up attacks against the homes, the residential homes of the Gaza Strip. This is really a sort of a dangerous development of the situation since the very beginning of the Israeli attacks on the region. A home has been struck by Israeli airplanes in the town where I live, actually. Five people, including a woman and a child, those two killed. For the hospitals in Gaza, as many staff have been lacking, sort of medicines have been lacking as well. There is a shortage of the medical supplies, and that has been warned by the hospital officials and the health officials in the territory.
On their part, Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza continued to fire rockets into different Israeli areas following the murder of Mohammed Abu Khdeir in Jerusalem by Israeli settlers. Armored groups vowed to continue the firing of shells in retaliation to the ongoing Israeli attacks targeting the Palestinian people. On Thursday, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the escalating violence. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon has asked for an immediate ceasefire. Japan, Egypt, and Jordan has issued statements condemning the latest series of Israeli assaults on the Palestinian community. Member of the Executive Committee of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, and Chief Palestinian Negotiator, Dr. Saab Erekat, has described the ongoing Israeli offensive against Gaza as an all-out systematic war against the national project and the national reconciliation. Egypt opened the Rafah crossing with Gaza to allow urgent aid to enter the region and facilitate the evacuation of injured Palestinians to nearby Egyptian hospitals. Israeli authorities declared this week that its armored forces are ready to deploy 40,000 reserve soldiers for a possible ground offensive in Gaza. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon said that the attacks on Gaza may take more than a few days. IMEMC spoke to Sergio Yanni, an Israeli political analyst from Jerusalem.
I don't believe the Israeli government has actually object in the current military operation on Gaza. I doubt Netanyahu knows what he's trying to achieve with this operation. He knows he will not destroy Hamas. He knows that unless he destroys and kills 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, he will not destroy Hamas. So what is alternative is? It means we are facing a meaningless violence, a totally irrational violence, an irrational government led by Netanyahu.
Also on Friday, weekly anti-wall and settlement protests were organized in Bel'in, Na'lin, and the Nabi Saleh in Central West Bank, in addition to the Southern West Bank village of Al-Ma'sara. Protests this week were in solidarity with the Gaza Strip and against the ongoing Israeli attacks. IMEMC spoke to Salah Al-Khawaja, a member of the Popular Struggle Committee that organizes the weekly non-violent protests.
The main message is to show that the Israeli occupation government and the settlers are using the Nazi policies and fascist practices in addition to mass killing and genocide. So the protesters today wore similar outfits the Nazis used to give to those they wanted to kill.
Israeli troops attacked the anti-wall and settlement protests with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Many civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Earlier in the week, at least 19 people were injured. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli soldiers invaded West Bank communities and clashed with local youth. Clashes were reported in the central West Bank city of Ramallah, as well as Hebron and Bethlehem cities in the southern West Bank. That's all for today from This Week in Palestine, Gaza special coverage. This was the weekly report for July 5th to the 11th, 2014, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This week's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Hassan Barnoura.
Since the early morning hours of Tuesday, July 8th, Israeli occupation forces have been bombing Gaza from air, land, and sea. According to the Gaza Health Ministry spokesperson, the Palestinian death toll has risen to 53 and at least 465 people have been injured. Earlier today, I spoke with Moin Rabbani, a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies and co-editor of Jadalia, about the underlying reasons for the latest Israeli assault on Gaza. But I first asked him to give us an update of the situation in Gaza Strip.
Today has seen a further escalation with, according to news reports, literally hundreds of sites throughout the Gaza Strip, which is already a very small territory, being bombed in some cases, repeatedly so, by the Israeli Air Force, land artillery, and Navy. And Hamas has responded with new missile barrages against Israeli cities. There's, of course, a vast discrepancy in the casualty figures, where I think something on the order of 30 to 40 Palestinians, mainly civilian non-combatants, have been killed, with at least 150 injured. And so far as I can tell from Israeli media reports, as of this afternoon, one Israeli lightly wounded by smoke inhalation.
And the narrative about the latest Israeli military assault on Gaza and its recent massive raid on the West Bank towns and villages revolves around three key events: the abduction and killings of three settler teenagers in Hebron area, killing of the 16-year-old Palestinian teenager from East Jerusalem, Muhammad Abu Khader, and the barrage of rockets fired into Israel. First off, how accurate is this narrative, which is being repeated over and over again? This is all we hear and read. How would you explain this new phase of Israeli attacks?
That rendition of events is fully accurate, provided you're willing to confuse Israeli propaganda with reality. The situation on the ground is somewhat different than has been painted by Israel, its supporters around the world, and overwhelmingly by the mainstream media as well. The starting point of this latest escalation was not the abduction and killing of these three Israeli youths in the Hebron district of the occupied West Bank. That was the first incident in almost a year of consistent escalation in which Israelis were killed. But, you know, less than a month previously, for example, we had the shooting deaths of two Palestinian teenagers in Ramallah, shot in the back by basically an Israeli settler on a hunting expedition. We've had all kinds of violence by settlers, by the military, and so on in the West Bank, as well as against Palestinians inside Israel, and a whole array of Israeli air raids and attacks on the Gaza Strip in this year as well. So, I mean, if you want to take specifically the Gaza Strip and how that situation has developed, just to go to the background, the latest confrontation between Israel on the one hand and Hamas and other Palestinian movements in the Gaza Strip was in 2012. That concluded with an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinians, as represented at the time by Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Mm-hmm. And this ceasefire had a number of conditions, including a cessation of Israeli assassination of Palestinian figures, allowing reconstruction materials into the Gaza Strip, a cessation of Palestinian rocket and missile attacks on Israeli territory, and so on. And I think, you know, any neutral observer would conclude that, on the whole, the ceasefire was not only more or less fully observed by its Palestinian signatories, but in addition to that, they did their best to enforce the ceasefire on other parties, primarily Salafi jihadi groups, who are quite small but nevertheless have some operational capacity in the Gaza Strip. Now, what happened in, I think it was December 2013, was that Israel carried out an assassination of a Salafi leader in the Gaza Strip. Now, relations between Hamas and the Salafis are actually extremely poor, and there have been armed confrontations between them in the past, and primarily in the Rafah district of the Gaza Strip, where one of the main leaders of the Palestinian Salafis was killed in an exchange of gunfire with Hamas. But as a result of this Israeli assassination, Hamas was no longer willing, or perhaps felt itself no longer capable of enforcing the ceasefire on these smaller grouplets in the Gaza Strip. And so, you know, they retaliated against the Israeli assassination. Israel, in turn, stepped up its attacks on the Gaza Strip and so on. And so we had this dynamic already in place well before the abduction and killing of these youths in the West Bank. Now, what happened in June last month is that virtually from the moment that these Israeli youths went missing in the occupied West Bank, Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, immediately held Hamas, others too, but primarily Hamas, responsible for this attack, and launched a huge campaign against Hamas, primarily in the West Bank, but also including a number of air raids against the Gaza Strip. Now, he presented this as putting pressure on Hamas in order to free these three abducted Israelis, whereas in fact we now know that the Israeli security forces knew almost from the outset, because of an emergency call that had been made by one of the Israelis and which was recorded on tape and in which gunfire could be heard. Netanyahu knew almost from the outset that, in fact, these three Israelis had been killed rather than abducted. Nevertheless, using the censorship powers of the Israeli state, this information was suppressed. Israel's activities were presented as a campaign to free live hostages. Mm. And that, in turn, was used in a very vulgar, demagogic fashion to whip up sentiment against not only Hamas, but basically Palestinians, you know, primarily among the Israeli public, but also internationally. And that really forms the background to the current escalation we're seeing.
And Mu'in, this massive, extensive wave of incursions into the West Bank hardly got any attention and coverage in the Western media. Israeli forces carried out more than 2,400 military raids, busting down doors, creating havoc at educational centers, businesses, civil society institutions, and homes. 600 Palestinians were arrested, 130 were injured, at least 7 were killed. And this is according to a report released by Swiss-based Euromed Observer for Human Rights. And also over $3 million were looted from the West Bank. Last month, in an article published in Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, you noted that many have speculated that Israel is also seeking to provoke mass Palestinian unrest at a time when Palestinians remain fragmented and are insufficiently organized and can be more easily beaten down. The Israeli campaign may also produce a sustained protest against the Palestinian Authority, PA, which, to the growing anger of its constituents, you say, has maintained unconditional security coordination with Israel, a relationship Abbas recently characterized as quote-unquote sacred. So what is the correlation between these factors and Israel's decision to declare an expanded and protected military assault on Gaza?
Well, I think you have to start with the Israeli claim, specifically Netanyahu's claim, that the killing of these three Israelis, or, you know, the abduction, as he put it, until the bodies were recovered, that this was an act by Hamas. Now, actually, the only fact we know is that Israel is searching for two Palestinians from the Hebron district who have gone missing and who Israel claims, perhaps correctly, are responsible for the killing of these three Israelis, and Israel claims that they are Hamas operatives. But, you know, it's actually quite a stretch because, first of all, it of course remains to be proven that these two individuals are responsible for these killings. Second of all, their affiliation with Hamas is somewhat opaque. The Israeli press was full of articles about how Hamas leaders, including Khaled Mashaal, had ordered the movement to abduct Israelis in order to exchange them for prisoners and so on. But, you know, it doesn't quite work that way. We don't know the extent to which these two individuals, assuming for the sake of argument that they are indeed responsible for this act, we don't know the extent to which they are affiliated with Hamas and were conducting organizational orders, or the extent to which, you know, they may have left the organization or carried out this act in an individual capacity or perhaps on behalf of some new organization we haven't heard of before, or perhaps a rival organization. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the claim that Hamas itself is responsible is very suspect, and also for another reason. I mean, anyone who's familiar with Palestinian politics knows that Palestinian movements, including Hamas, have never been coy about taking responsibility for their actions, or for that matter, exaggerating their actions by taking responsibility for the actions of others. What we've seen in this case is Hamas not just not claiming responsibility for this act, but denying involvement. Now, on what basis would they go out of their way to claim they had nothing to do with it? Well, initially, there may have been an operational reason, so to speak, you know, that if these three Israelis were indeed alive and those who abducted them were trying to secure them and so on, then it would make sense that you wouldn't yet see a claim of responsibility. But, you know, that rationale, if it existed, has ceased to exist long ago. Yet Israel continues to insist that this was a Hamas action for which the movement is responsible, but that case is at best unproven and, in fact, extremely, extremely flimsy. Now, how does this tie in with what we're seeing in the Gaza Strip now? Well, on the one hand, the Israeli military rampage throughout the West Bank was very much directed at Hamas, not only Hamas, but primarily Hamas. It also included, for example, the re-imprisonment of Palestinian detainees who had been released in 2011 in the context of the prisoner exchange.
Yeah, they re-arrested them.
They re-arrested many of them, yes. And this was basically, you know, Israel trying to erase the stain of having been forced to negotiate for getting the Israeli soldier who had been taken prisoner by Hamas back, and basically trying to show, you know, that they retained the capacity to invalidate and nullify and reverse any agreements that they may make with Hamas or other Palestinians. But in addition to that, there was a very clear Israeli escalation against the Gaza Strip. And again, you know, this has to do with this Israeli habit of whenever it's faced with increasing diplomatic and public relations difficulty, of trying to change the narrative, to put it simply, from colonialism to terrorism. You know, it's not about Israel's insatiable appetite for Palestinian land. It's not about Israeli soldiers going on hunting expeditions against Palestinian civilian noncombatants in the occupied territories. No, the real story, you know, is this mortal threat posed by Hamas rockets and missiles in the Gaza Strip that, again, according to the press so far, that according to the Israeli press, have so far resulted in a single Israeli casualty, namely someone who inhaled smoke from a field set on fire by one of these mortars.
And also, Moin, this happens at a time when Israel was experiencing international scrutiny for its policies, as well as notable gains by the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
I think the more important point here is that there has been, and I suspect there will continue to be, a growing realization, you know, not just in the places where that realization has more or less always existed, but also in places where it is arguably diplomatically more important, like in Europe and to some extent also in the United States, you know, Australia and Canada and some Pacific Islands remaining the main exceptions, that this entire peace process is a sham and a charade, and that it's primarily so because Israel is using it as nothing more than a cover to legitimize, or at least to carry out, its continued colonial expansion into occupied territory, and that the United States, given its extreme pro-Israeli partisanship in what's called the peace process, is perhaps uniquely ill-suited to sponsor Israeli-Palestinian diplomacy. And in Europe, for example, in the past year, we've seen some quite significant decisions banning cooperation with any Israeli entity that conducts activities over the Green Line, or at least banning such entities from participation in any of the existing cooperation agreements. Unfortunately, I think, if I understand correctly, current European policy is that settlement products, in other words, Israeli products originating from the illegal Jewish settlements in occupied territories, need to be properly labeled. In other words, they cannot be labeled as regular Israeli products and thereby enjoy the various import duty exemptions and other preferential access that what the EU considers to be legitimate Israeli products have in the European market. Of course, in a rational world, settlement products would be treated similar to blood diamonds from conflict areas in Africa and simply banned from the European market altogether, rather than labeled differently.
So how do you see these factors, both, as we say, the scrutinization of Israeli policies, occupational policies, as well as these incremental gains by the BDS movement, in why Israel decided to basically create a story and a diversion by attacking Gaza?
Well, I don't want to belittle the BDS movement, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that Israel is formulating policy as a response to the BDS movement.
Mm-hmm.
It's formulating policy primarily in response to developments on the ground in the occupied Palestinian territories, and in addition to that, to the potentially shifting diplomatic environment, where it's, you know, much more concerned about decisions taken in Brussels, you know, than some university in the U.S. Midwest, so to speak. And I think, you know, for Israel, one of the important and worrisome developments for it this year has been that, for a variety of reasons, the Palestinians have taken tentative steps towards national reconciliation. In other words, there's been an agreement between Fatah and Hamas, not the first agreement, but yet, you know, one more agreement to try to end the schism in the Palestinian national movement that has existed since 2007.
Yeah.
And the difference this time is that the two parties actually agreed on the formation of a new government, rather than being a unity government or coalition government that included representatives of various political parties. This was formed as an independent government that had the endorsement of the various political movements. And on that basis, the key funders of the Palestinian Authority, primarily the EU and the U.S., made clear that they would cooperate with this new government rather than boycott and sanction it. And for Israel, Palestinian division and fragmentation, and maintaining and deepening such fragmentation and division, has been a strategic priority, you know, for decades, and particularly in the past decade. And Israel has consistently sought to undermine any Palestinian progress towards reconciliation, because basically it prefers a situation where one part of the occupied territories is ruled by militant Islamists like Hamas, and another is ruled by a exceedingly pliant leader committed to security coordination, all the rest of it, in the form of Mahmoud Abbas. Mm-hmm. It prefers that division even to a unified system that would be led by someone who is much more amenable to their agenda than some of the leaders of a divided polity. And so, you know, one key objective that Israel has been hoping to achieve in the past month is to put Hamas and Abbas under sufficient pressure that the modest progress that has been made in the recent reconciliation agreement will be reversed.
Can you remind us exactly what happened, what led to the formation of this unity government?
Briefly, due to a variety of developments, both parties were in increasingly desperate straits and kind of needed the other as a lifeline to survival. In the case of Hamas, the coup in Egypt, and the unprecedented hostility of the new Egyptian regime towards the Gaza Strip and Hamas in particular, and the deterioration of relations between Hamas and the so-called axis of resistance, consisting of Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah, has led to a very serious deterioration in its financial situation, and not only in its ability to import goods into the Gaza Strip, but even to pay the salaries of its own civil servants. And therefore, one of the key components of the recent reconciliation agreements was that the new government would pay not only, would continue to pay not only the salaries of, let's say, the official PA civil servants, but also those in the Gaza Strip who had been appointed by Hamas to government jobs after the schism in 2007, and this was a major issue for Hamas. The second issue was that Hamas was hoping that through a reconciliation agreement that the leadership in Ramallah would be able to negotiate a normalization of the Rafah crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. Now, neither of those have materialized, and I think that helps to explain why Hamas is not shrinking back from a new conflict with Israel if Israel insists on escalation. Seen from the vantage point of Ramallah, Abbas's political strategy has basically been a total failure, not only because of the extremism of the Netanyahu government, but perhaps even more importantly because of the extremism of the Obama administration and Kerry's various proposals, which gave Abbas nothing and left him looking like a very, very naked emperor. And he was therefore hoping to recoup at least some of his legitimacy by being responsible for the reunification of the Palestinian political system, even though he was largely responsible for its division in the first place.
Doctors in Gaza are saying that the closure of smuggling tunnels between Gaza and Egypt, which has been the main lifeline through which medical supplies were brought into Gaza during the last Israeli attacks in 2012, has really exacerbated the situation there.
Yes, and I think, in fact, one thing Hamas will be hoping is that, you know, if this turns into a prolonged conflict and you begin to see these horrific images of suffering and need and so on television screens throughout the Arab world, and particularly in Egypt, as we did in 2012 and 2008, that will generate increasing pressure on the Sisi government to stop treating the Gaza Strip as an appendage of the Muslim Brotherhood, with which the Sisi government is in mortal combat, but rather to begin viewing them as Palestinians and Arabs who deserve and should be enjoying the natural solidarity of the Arab world, and first and foremost of the Egyptians. And so it's hoping that this may generate public or other forms of pressure on the Egyptian government to relax that siege. Whether that will succeed or not is a very open question.
So you are saying that Hamas is hoping to benefit from this attack?
Well, of course. I mean, I don't think that this is an attack that, or I don't think that this is a confrontation that Hamas provoked. I don't think it's one that it sought out. I think it's one that it hoped to avoid. You know, but once the Israeli government decided to roll the dice, I think the thinking within very, very influential elements of Hamas has been, you know, we should go all the way rather than fold and be spectators while this is happening. And we should also seek to instrumentalize this conflict to meet some of our organizational goals, primarily, as I was just saying, relating to the relationship with Egypt and the Rafah crossing. And I should add, I also haven't seen convincing evidence that a very serious escalation and a ground invasion is seen by Israel, and particularly by its security establishment, as being in Israel's interest. I mean, Netanyahu has been talking very tough and so on, but I think the Israelis too recognize that the alternatives to returning to some kind of informal understanding, ceasefire with Hamas, the alternatives to that could be very much worse for Israel.
So what will this attack do to the unity government or plans for Hamas and the Palestinian Authority to come together and form a unity government?
I think it's difficult to give a definitive answer to that question at this point, but what we've seen so far is that, you know, while Israel has been launching this increasingly violent and comprehensive campaign against Hamas, not only in the Gaza Strip, but also in the West Bank, the Palestinian government in the West Bank has been continuing with security cooperation with Israel against Hamas, with whom it supposedly has just reconciled, and in many respects is acting as if the Gaza Strip doesn't exist. So this is obviously putting the modest progress there already has been under severe pressure, and may well lead to an unraveling of the agreement, and perhaps further down the line, the appointment of a new and independent government in the Gaza Strip, not independent of Hamas, of course, but independent, you know, from the one that they've recently endorsed. I think that's a very real possibility. I think, you know, that would be a blow to Abbas as well, because it would serve to further discredit him. And so the noises he's now been making about going to the International Criminal Court and so on, well, I think these are, you know, tactical threats rather than serious strategic considerations, I think are in part intended to forestall such a scenario.
Is there anything different when it comes to what Israel's objectives are this time around?
I think it is, in the sense that you have two factors that are different this time than we had in 2008 and 2012. First, as we've already discussed, you have this actually existing reconciliation agreement and its partial implementation. Yeah. In effect, its acceptance by key Israeli allies, Brussels and Washington, and on that basis, the prospect of further progress in Palestinian reconciliation. And this is something that Israel feels the need to subvert almost as a, and sabotage almost as a strategic objective. Secondly, you have this broader political environment in which the latest attempt at U.S.-sponsored Israeli-Palestinian talks has collapsed, and while personally I think it's quite likely that they will be resumed towards the end of this year, the opinion in much of the world, including among key Israeli allies, seems to be that it's largely Israel and its policies and American partisanship towards Israel that is to blame, and this could over time lead to a fundamental reconsideration of the diplomatic paradigm that's been applied to this conflict. And so those are kind of two issues that Israel has very much in the crosshairs in its recent campaign.
Where do you think this is going?
Well, there's a real sense that this could spiral out of control. As I suggested earlier, neither Hamas nor Israel appear to have a real interest in a full-scale confrontation, which could lead eventually to a massive Israeli ground invasion of the Gaza Strip, because basically Israel doesn't have any alternatives to the current reality that exists in the Gaza Strip, or certainly no alternatives that would appear to better serve Israeli interests. But the issue is that from Hamas's point of view, it's been so isolated that very influential factors within the movement, particularly some that are associated with the military wing, feel that, you know, this is the time to stand their ground, and that by doing so, they can force a better dispensation and a better implementation of previous agreements that they've negotiated with Israel. Now, if that prognosis is correct, this could go on for a long time, almost despite the intentions of both parties. I think when this started, my suspicion is that, you know, I already indicated Israel's objectives, and on top of that, it wanted to give the Palestinians a bloody nose. Mm. I think Hamas wanted to show that, you know, it can not only absorb a bloody nose, but give one back just as well. But these things have a tendency of taking on a life of their own. I mean, it's much easier to initiate a conflict than to dictate how and when it's going to end.
Yeah, because in the London Review of Books, you just published a column in which you say the unremitting hostility of Egypt's new rulers to Gaza and Hamas means there isn't a credible mediator unless Turkey or Qatar steps into the breach.
Yes, I mean, I think Turkey and Qatar are two parties that enjoy not only good relations with Hamas, but also have sufficiently good relations with Israel that they could step into the breach left by Egypt. The problem is that relations between Egypt on the one hand and Turkey and Qatar on the other are effectively no better than relations between Egypt and Hamas, and it would be very difficult to see how either Turkey or Qatar could mediate without Egyptian facilitation. I think, you know, if this conflict does very significantly escalate, particularly if it continues over a prolonged period of time, the prospect for renewed Egyptian mediation increase.
Moin Rabbani is a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies and co-editor of Jadalia.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment here on 90.3 FM Newton WZBC that is part of Truth and Justice Radio, which airs every Sunday from 6 to 10 a.m. at 90.3 on your FM dial. We hope that you will join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.